Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for the Doctors Roundtable, a forum for conversations with Atlanta's leading doctors and thought leaders about cutting-edge trends and topics in health, wellness, and lifestyle issues. Here's our host, Tanya Mack.
Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you so much for taking time to join us this afternoon. Our topic this afternoon is very timely and I think doesn't really get as much press or attention as probably is warranted. Today, we're going to be talking about updating information that you might need to know about hepatitis A, B, and C. World Hepatitis Day was last month, July 28th. So it's a kind of a timely time to look at the problem, and it's kind of become a very global issue. I found in my research an estimated 1 to 3 million deaths occur globally, and for hepatitis A and B, well, a lot of that's preventable. My guest today, I've been waiting 9 months to see. I'm thrilled that he's here. He is a noted expert nationally for sure, maybe globally. He can tell us about that. I have in the studio with me Dr. Enrique Martinez, and let me tell you a little bit about him. He got his medical training at the University of South Florida, and he is board certified in both internal medicine and also gastroenterology, but that was not enough. He had an interest in hepatology, and he went on to get advanced training, another fellowship at the University of Miami in hepatology, and continued on into liver transplantation for even more. So he's a noted author in peer-reviewed journals. He's a guest lecturer all over. He is now practicing with Atlanta Gastroenterology Associates, and he's based at Emory Midtown in Atlanta. So welcome, Dr. Martinez.
Thank you very much for having us here.
I can tell already you're going to be worth the wait. So why don't we start with the listeners just talking a little bit about, I mentioned the incidence and prevalence of hepatitis. So let's talk a little bit about what have you seen here in our community? What are you seeing in the U.S. as far as trending and the problem scope of this disease? And globally, I know we're going to talk about different populations, but why don't you just kind of tell us how big this issue is?
Well, to give you an example, in hepatitis A in this country, you're looking at about 9,000 cases. That's based on CDC data nationwide. It's always a couple years old, so you always wonder if it's more or less. But it's been pretty consistent around that 9,000 there recently. That's for hep A. For hep B, you're looking at about 38,000. And then for hep C, you're looking at about 16,000. That's every year of the acute cases. Now, there is no chronic hep A because, you know, hep A either kills you or it doesn't. And, you know, it sounds facetious to a certain extent, but it does. It can have a death rate. And the older you are and you get it, the higher chance that you have mortality. And that's important when you think about all these older Americans who are retired. They take a cruise to the Caribbean and they've never been vaccinated for hepatitis A and they come back with an acute hep A. Things could be touch and go with grandma on that one. The other issue then for the hepatitis B is that the load in this country as far as chronic hepatitis is about 1.4 million, but some people estimate it could be as high as 2.2 million because a lot of it's from immigrants that don't necessarily have that testing, that possibility. 70% of the hep B chronic load in this country is actually from immigrants because they're coming from countries where they're not vaccinated for this, as has been the practice in the United States since about 1991 from this aspect. And then the hep C has, unfortunately, as you've anybody who's ever been in Atlanta lately at Hartsfield has seen the ads, you know, you see this picture of MASH, you see the Brady Bunch, and it's, you know, catches your eye, and all of a sudden it says, you know, by the way, you should be tested, you know, for hepatitis C. And the reason they're doing that is they're screening the people, the cohort from 1945 to 1965, to try to identify hepatitis C. About approximately 3.9 million Americans are estimated to have hep C. Some data suggests it may be higher. Again, a lot of people aren't exactly screened, tested, monitored for this, the homeless, incarcerated, et cetera. So a lot of that data is not there. Georgia, interesting on all these numbers, just, you know, kind of looked at the global number there. It's about 40 cases of hep A that have been reported, but there's a fudge factor in that it's grossly unreported. Those numbers I gave you, 9,000, it's because, you know, you look at the actual numbers, it's like a fudge factor of 8 to 10 times is the real number. So they may say 40, but it's probably in the order of 3 to 400, you know, but nobody knows. The reported number for hep B is about 165, probably bigger, closer in the thousands, you know, from that aspect. And then for the hep C, reported number is about 32. So again, all these numbers kind of have to be blown up into what the real numbers are, but it's there. I mean, I think what happens is the vast majority of people, they get diagnosed. You may see they get diagnosed at the hospital. They get a blood work. They don't show up. a lot of this data gets lost in the shuffle from that. So take these same numbers and let's go global. Hep A, 1.5 million people get it each year. That's a lot of attention there on that one. Mm-hmm. Hep B, 350 million carriers. Mm. And Hep C, 150 million carriers in the world from this aspect. And so one of the people say, well, what's wrong with having hepatitis? Well, you could die. In the United States, out of our 9,000 people who die, who have acute Hep A every year, about 100 people die. That's not a big number. You know, you think about it, gosh, you know, 100 people is not a lot for the United States, you know, 300 some odd million people. But 50% of those people have chronic hepatitis. So that brings to mind that if you have chronic hepatitis, you're supposed to be vaccinated and you could drop the death rate by 50%. Now, that sounds really impressive when a vaccine, two shots, can prevent a death rate by 50% in this country. Mm-hmm. So that's
it sounds easy until you realize in developing countries, they don't have access to very much food or water, let alone medicine sometimes.
Yes.
So that is why we have a global problem.
If you've ever talked to a missionary, and there are a lot of missionaries in Atlanta, I don't know why, but you know, we're a huge amount of missionaries.
We're in the Bible Belt. What do you mean when you have missionaries here?
I see these people and they tell me about that. They go, their kids are there and they're with them in Africa and they're going to get a vaccine. And then what happens is their kid is the first one in honor. They open up the sterile syringe. They draw up their vaccine. Their kid gets it. And then they turn their back and they're moving. And all of a sudden, every other kid in line is getting a shot with this same vaccine. And then all of a sudden you come to mind, oh my gosh, this is the roots of this horrible Hep B and hepatitis C mm-hmm. problem that happened.
We're perpetuating it, just giving it. Right?
Egypt, you know, it's mm-hmm. in the news today, right? Really hot, all the things happening. You know, there was a schistosomiasis program. They went village to village using the same syringe for I don't know how many people, and you ended up having almost 25% of Egyptians having Hep C mm-hmm. with the same genotype, type 4.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, scary stuff. Well, you certainly have a need for your skills with that kind of a problem going around. But tell us how you got interested in hepatology to begin with.
I did my training in Tampa. And while I was there, one of our former chairmen who was still very active in the program was Dr. H. Worth Boyce. He's famous for a variety of things. Most recently, he's actually officially retired now. He was a specialist in esophagology. Esophagology was the study of the esophagus, but before that, in I guess one of his first versions of his interest, he was a laparoscopist. He used to do laparoscopy, do a lot of liver disease. So that really caught my attention because when I was a fellow working with him, he would do laparoscopies and we were getting some exposure to that, but not as much because, Dr. Boyce had been slowing down, but he had friends that would come visit and, you know, he would bring people like Dr. Will Madry from Texas. He would bring, you know, people like Eugene Schiff in. And I was invited when I was still a medical student because I had expressed interest in general gastroenterology. And Gene Schiff showed up. He had about 5 carousels. And I had taken a few pages there. And before I knew it, I was writing on, you know, the menu. And then there was a couple of, you know, different sheets of, you know, paper that I could find that I, you know, obviously was going to have to make some restitution the next day to try to make up for that. But wrote down so many notes and he had so many answers. And I said, gosh, I've got to work with this person because he's got all the answers that nobody else had. And so I had the pleasure of working with him additionally for 2 years after that in Miami. And you mentioned the fellowship, but I actually am a tortured soul. I actually have a third board certification in liver transplant. And so that's a big issue because every 10 years I get to renew. And so while everybody else does their one board or two, I have the pleasure
inundated.
Of 6 years of nothing but board preparation, and then I get 4 years off.
Yeah. So are you retest? Are we back to retesting? Or are you actually taking the coursework so you get
you
reboarded?
Have to do – it's a whole series of tests. You have to do tests before the test, then there's the mm-hmm. test, and then there's recommendations, and then there's quality assurances and mm-hmm. lots of different things, all of which, you know, no problems with that, mm-hmm. you know, but it's fun. It's mm-hmm. fun. In a certain way, and it kind of makes you feel good to feel that you can still do that. And it's always interesting. And, you know, every day I get questions asked of me by patients. I see patients. So a board test to me is a challenge. It's just like another day at work. You know,
so education for you and reassurance for me.
Yes.
That's right.
Makes you feel better that I did it again.
That's right. Well, let's start at the beginning with hepatitis A, and we'll kind of just breeze through just an overview of it. You know, how do patients present? How do you diagnose this? What populations? How is it transmitted? Just the basics.
You know, you can almost say the same presentation for every hepatitis. Mm-hmm. So there's the typical fatigue, you know, that people have. There's the typical nausea, vomiting, don't feel right, a little diarrhea, maybe a little bit of a low-grade temperature. But usually it's that jaundice that's usually the ding, you know, turkey's done and everybody knows that they're ready to kind of come in. Between, if you look at Hep A, B, and C, pretty much all of them have about between a half to, you know, 3/4 of them will have jaundice from this aspect. Mm-hmm. And an easy number to remember is between about 40 to about 60% of them will end up getting admitted from this aspect when they have acute hepatitis. Why? They get dehydrated. Mm-hmm. They don't feel good. What happens? I mean, so if you're single and, you know, single person's out there doing maybe higher risk behavior from this aspect and they're the ones that come down with the acute hepatitis, who's going to take care of them? Mm-hmm. That person that they were with for that wonderful
one night
is not going to show up there and take care of now the yellow person who's right. in bed with diarrhea.
Looking pretty scary.
Yes, and looking very kind of zombie-like in activities and stuff like mm-hmm. that. So and so what happens, they end up invariably getting dehydrated. They end up coming to the emergency room. They may or may not be in denial about their jaundice, or a coworker say, you better get in, your jaundice, and then they kind of get in from that aspect. And so I'll give you an example of cost. Hep A has about a $488 million cost. And this was in the last time they calculated in the late 90s. And, you know, other than housing, which, you know, has come down, everything else in medicine has gone up. So I tend to believe it's more than $488 million now if they were to recalculate it. Hep B actually was $1.3 billion. Mm-hmm. So now you take that money and you would have paid for a vaccine program, mm-hmm. you could have probably paid for the vaccine program.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so let's talk about the Hep A vaccine.
Yes.
One shot?
Two shots, actually. Okay. One shot will work if you're going to do like a transient trip sort of thing. Mm-hmm. The two-shot principle gives you pretty much, you know, they estimate at least 10 to 20 years for the Hep A vaccine. It's extremely immune-producing. It's actually a killed virus. And that's an important issue because that's why it's so immunogenic. The original Hep B vaccine was also a killed virus, but it kind of, you know, because it came from blood, the people who potentially could have had HIV got mutated to a recombinant, you know, single protein particle. And so it's been less immunogenic. But the Hep A vaccine, pretty much, you know, most people think it could potentially last you your whole life mm-hmm. From that aspect. And there have been studies at least even 20 years out that the antibody is still present in most of the people. Mm-hmm. And remember, there's always that famous amnestic cell. That's the one that can remember things when you can't. And so you may not remember you ever had it, but it remembers it, and then it builds itself back up and tries to protect you. So it's a series of two doses, at least 6 months apart, but it is forgiving, and you could do it 6 to 12 months apart if you had to from that aspect.
And school children prophylactically vaccinated?
I think that's mandatory.
Since when?
That's a good question. Let's talk a little bit about the history of hepatitis A. If you look at Hep A in this country, remember we talked about it's 9,000 now? It was 135,000 people back in around 1990. So we've had, thanks to the Hep A program that was instituted by the ACIP, they've actually reduced that by 90%. Just an example of how bad Hep A is worldwide, the number one reason that children in Argentina needed a liver transplant until, you know, maybe about the last 5 to 10 years was acute Hep A leading to fulminant failure. So we didn't see that in this country thanks to the program that was initiated here, and they were able to bring it down. They first gave it to high risk, then moderate risk, and then they said, oh my gosh, look at these numbers. Look at how much of this drop it. Every kid gets it. So every kid now gets it after age one, between age 1 and 2 from this aspect. And that's been in place pretty much probably for about the last 6 to 7 years that every kid get it. It was phased in over 1996 to that time frame. And so the pediatricians do a great job of doing that. Now, the problem you're going to say, well, why until 1 year of age? So, you know, well, it's kind of letting the immune system kind of get there. There are other vaccines that kids are getting, you know, that are also, you know, important. You can only give a kid that's got small extremities so many shots. So that's an important issue. But one of the things also that's important is the kids don't get it till 1 year of age. Now, for anybody who's ever had children, who's ever, you know, had a little bit of a runny nose, a low-grade temperature, you're headed off to work, and where does mom or dad leave you? Do they think that they don't take you to the daycare with those symptoms? What if the child, mom and dad had been on a trip? You know, we've been out of the places. Everybody brings their kid with them, right? Mm-hmm. And so kid goes on a trip. Mom and dad drop them off at the daycare. The kids are there under 1 year of age. You know, they lick everything in sight. And so next thing you know, body fluid exposures, and you hear hepatitis A epidemic at the daycare.
Mm-hmm.
So you say, well, hi, they're all vaccinated. Yeah, the kids who are 2 and up are all vaccinated, or 1 to 2 and up are all vaccinated, but not below 1.
So really we're concerned with Hep A on making sure we get the vaccines early, which
yes.
are mandatory, but we have a population on the other end that
yes.
never had the vaccines, may not know they're infected or whatever, that are at the elderly population.
Yes, if you actually look at it, the adults – going forward, from 19 going forward, you're looking at about only about a 9 to 12% vaccine administration rate. Right. So you're saying basically if there's a Hep A epidemic in Georgia right now, 10% of the people will be okay.
Yeah, right.
And the elderly are more extreme. Here's the thing. Now, guess what? For Hep A, elderly means over 40.
Right.
If you're over 40,
don't
the death rate is
saying that. What
well,
are you talking about?
But that's for Hep A. Over 40, right. the death rate, you know, starts to creep up there. Okay. And then you start getting grandma, granddad, you know, in their 70s, came on that cruise. You know, grandma's got a little touch of heart failure, but she's doing okay. Granddad's got a stent and so forth. And then all of a sudden, you know, you get this hepatitis A, they have a bilirubin of about 20, they don't eat, grandma got it too because it's very easily spread, and you know, it starts becoming an issue there.
Very good. All right, let's move along to hepatitis B.
Oh, Hep B.
Hep B. So you talked about a lot is the same as far as symptoms
yes.
that they might see. So we can, are there any additional symptoms that would be unique to Hep B?
You know, Hep B is one of those interesting diseases that you know, half the people don't have a symptom at all. And I think that's important because you're going to say, well, how can so many people worldwide kind of live with this? They just don't know they have it.
Mm-hmm. One of the silent killer
it
diseases.
It is. Mm-hmm. In this country alone, you know, just for example, I mean, I'm sure you've talked about HIV before and stuff like that. You know, ID doctors are actually absolutely offended and really upset that they have 20% of the HIV patients in this country don't know that they have HIV. What would happen if they knew that 2/3 of the Hep B patients don't know they have it? And then we talked already, alluded a little bit about that 3/4 of the Hep C patients in this country don't know they have it. So you have a
lot of people walking around out there, clueless.
Exactly, clueless. So let's say we talk about areas of the world, you know, like, you know, Southeast Asia. 1 in 8 people have hepatitis B. You know, how'd they get it? You know, they got it from because they were born. You know, mom is actively replicating, you know, she's immune tolerant, not a candidate for treatment, you know, and back then there was probably no treatment, you know, mm-hmm. so many years ago. And then mom, you know, has a billion virus, you know, and anything over a million copies, they can have a significant spread risk. So if you give right now in this country or any parts of the world that have the program, the hepatitis B immune globulin, Hep B vaccine to the child at birth, the child, if the mom's e-antigen positive and high replicative like that, has a 10 to 15% chance of getting it. Otherwise, it'd be 90%. Mm-hmm. So now, same mom has less than 200,000 international units or 1 million copies. And the reason to go back and forth is some mm-hmm. countries do copies. I mean, that, you know, it's like metric and mm-hmm. inches. You know, we're
right.
an inches country, whereas the rest of the world is metric. You know, from this aspect, well, some people in the rest of the world do copies. We do international units. So mm-hmm. so it's 200
it's
international units.
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
reported in difference. The same numbers are conversion factors. But if you'd give a mom in the third trimester some of the current therapies that are available, you can bring the DNA level down and you can make that rate virtually none. The reason that they wait till the third trimester is they're afraid of organogenesis. All these drugs, you know, what people don't realize is Hep B, as opposed to Hep A and Hep C, is a DNA virus. You're never really rid of Hep B. Mm-hmm. It's in your genome. It gets in there. It hides in there. Mm-hmm. You could have Hep B acute, get over it. 40 years later, you get diagnosed with breast cancer, colon cancer, lymphoma, God forbid, or get a kidney transplant. They give you some immune suppression or strong chemo, and next thing you know, you got Hep B.
Yeah, it was embedded in there.
It's embedded in there. And it's that covalently closed circular DNA, or as they like to call it, CCC DNA, that we really can't really hit at for that. And Hep A doesn't come back. Sometimes it doesn't want to go away easily, and it could take 6 months to a year to go away, but it eventually goes away. But Hep B, if you get this as a kid, 95% it's going to stick with you for the rest of your life. 5% you can get over it. Get this as an adult, 95% it's going to go away. 5% that it won't. So you're dealing with that. In this country, in the United States, people get exposed usually in their late teens, 20s, you know, going forward. In fact, the biggest population right now is 20 to 45-year-olds are coming down with it. And obviously the risk factor is exactly what you just thought,
mm-hmm.
sexual activity.
Mm-hmm.
From this aspect, it's the biggest risk factor that people mm-hmm. have. Mm-hmm. It's about half the people that could remember how they got it,
mm-hmm.
which, by the way, is a minority of the people can remember how they got it, remember somehow it's sexually linked.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, we do things. What can I say? But I do want to talk about the vaccination for
yes.
Hep B because, again, the message is there's a vaccine for it.
Absolutely.
So it's absolutely preventable. And why don't we talk about that? That's a series of three.
Okay. It's a series of three shots. And, you know, before we go to that, it's interesting to know two things about the Hep B vaccine.
Mm-hmm.
What's the number one cause of cancer in human beings, you know, by the World Health Organization standards? It's obviously smoking, right? The number two cause of cancer in human beings in the world is Hep B. So when they came out with the Hep B vaccine, it was really, inadvertently,
helping the cancer statistic.
The first anti-cancer vaccine. So Hep B is an anti-cancer vaccine. And, you know, most of us go to these warehouse clubs. Everybody likes, you know, you get the two big bottles of the mouthwash, and then you get that little travel bottle, and everybody got, what a deal. Well, if you get vaccinated for Hep B and you get the series, you prevent Hep D. So that's great because Hep D is a defective virus. It actually encodes itself with Hep B. And so if you have no Hep B or can't get Hep B, you can't get Hep D. So warehouse clubs, you know, anybody getting the vaccine think you're getting something extra. Yeah. So from that aspect, two ways to get it. As a monovalent, meaning single vaccine, it's 0, 1, and 6 months from this aspect. And if you miss it or whatever, people just pick up on the series from there, from that aspect. The antibody titer after one dose is present in about a third. Two doses, you get about three quarters. You really got to get all three doses to get that 90%+. Now, again.
And what percent of patients would you guess actually follow through the series?
Probably not as many as you think. In hospitals, I hear this all the time, that they in the first month they're mandated to do their employee health stuff. They get their vaccine. They get the first dose. They may get the second dose. Now they've been working there for about 5 to 6 months. They may be in a different part. They may be working like in our system. They're in one hospital versus another area. And then next thing you know, they'll forget and all those things. Probably about at best maybe two-thirds of the people finish if you're lucky. And then again, if you're over 40 and you get the vaccine, it's not me. I know you don't have this thing about over 40, but it's not me. But this is the statistic is you have to realize the vaccine manufacturers, they're kids, right? So if you're over 40, you're ancient to these people. So from that aspect. So going back to over 40, you give the Hep B vaccine to people over 40. Instead of getting a 90-95% take rate if you get all three, if you give this to young people from that aspect, you get about an 80%. Now, Hep B also exists as a combined vaccine with Hep A. So let's say that you don't have Hep A, you don't have Hep B. There's a vaccine combination available for that, and there are two ways to give it. You can get it at zero, which is day one. You can get it at 1 week, and then again at 3 to 4 weeks, and then a one-year booster, and that would protect you. Or you can get the 0, 1, and 6 months. What they did is they took the Hep A, they spread it out over that, and it's still that. But it allows you to potentially, let's say you're going overseas, you're a soldier, and this is what the military does. They give them the three doses in a month, and they're kind of protected now against Hep A and B. From this aspect. So that's an issue. When did the vaccine program go into effect? 1991. That's interesting because when you look at that incidence, I told you about the incidence of hepatitis B in this country, it's interesting. It's absolutely dead quiet for Hep B until about age 19. Well, the quick math is the program went into effect in 1991. That's a few years old. So it's almost like, oh my gosh, the vaccine is working. You're fooling yourself if you're thinking nobody's sexually active before age 19. From that aspect.
Right.
I mean, I remember when, this was, back in the 1980s, one of my first OBGYN rotations, a 13-year-old delivering. Well, that means she was sexually active at 12. So it just gives you an idea about that.
Yeah, very good. Okay, and the vaccine for Hep B, is there any statistics on how long you're immune then?
Now, that's a controversial one.
Okay.
You'd like to delve into controversy on that one. So here's the controversy on it. A lot of people get the vaccine and aren't required to show that it took immunity. If they show that it took immunity, it's felt that it's probably going to lead again to those famous memory cells, the amnestic cells, and that if they're exposed again, the memory cells, will remember and will form the antibody. Now, that being said, personal example, I got the vaccine series, and our medical school required us in Tampa to have proof before you got to the wards, meaning the actual patient care, that you had antibody. Well, I did that. I did my GI, and then all of a sudden I head down to Miami, and Miami tells me, oh, you're not detectable. You need to get a booster. Well, Dr. Schiff, I don't need to take a vaccine, do I? This and that. Martinez, if you don't do it, you're not going on the floors. You better take it. So I did. I've been over 150 now for the last 20 years, from that aspect ever since I took that booster. So, again, going back to that issue, is it the amnestic cells are probably there and you get the booster and it works. CDC was supposed to come out with guidelines, and I haven't seen that in print, but they were going to finally try to answer the riddle of the chicken versus the egg. And at the end of the day, I think that there's still some controversy. What I tell my patients is, look, if you're in a high-risk job, you're a nurse, you're a doctor, you're working in
a
dialysis center, and you've got a titer that's not detectable, does it hurt you to get the booster? No, it doesn't. And then take it, let the titer go up, and let the research scientists argue later on, because you'll be the one not worried about that next needle stick with a Hep B patient.
Okay, very good. All right, the big kahuna, hepatitis C.
Oh, my gosh.
Here we go.
Where shall we skin this cat?
Well, I have no idea. Where would you like to start?
You know, I think it's interesting to talk about Hep C as an interesting entity. We talked about, you know, Hep B being the 350 million. And in this country, we didn't talk about death rate, you know, except for the Hep A, we hinted at it. But the death rate in this country from Hep B is about 1,600 from this aspect a year. And that was back in, you know, the last reporting cycle around 2009, 2010. Hep C, you know, we talked about it's 150 million worldwide. We talked about it's only about 3.9 million, which is more than the Hep B. Its death rate's going to shock you when I tell you that it's like 16,000, you know, from, you know, the last reporting cycle. You're thinking 16,000? Wait, it's only twice as big as Hep B, but yet it's got 16,000, three times the death rate there or more. So a lot of stuff going on.
Doesn't
add up from that aspect. And a lot of it has to do with it's still the number one cause for cirrhosis leading to a transplant, although fatty liver will displace that probably in the next 5 to 10 years, you know, from this aspect. That's really the big one coming. That's the big tsunami coming from that aspect. But that's a whole different radio show from that aspect. But the hepatitis C, you know, back in the 1990 time frame, we didn't know it as Hep C. It was non-A, non-B. In fact, Dr. Schiff and Gary Davis's paper that talked about the treatment of it was the treatment of non-A, non-B with interferon. We started off with about an 8% cure rate, which back then we didn't really think was 8%. We thought it was 20% because we were following ALT. Then somebody came out with an RNA, went back, and they realized, oh my gosh, half those people still had the virus. No wonder that it comes back after X amount of months. So once we had that, then we actually learned to distinguish the virus types. We figured out that longer interferon was better. 6 months gave us 8%. You know, a year gave us, you know, 15 to 20. And, you know, 72 weeks gave us, you know, close to 30. Then came a little drug called ribavirin. That was one of my research projects when I worked with Dr. Schiff. I got the chance to work with 3TC, which became Epivir, the first oral drug for Hep B. It was also already an HIV drug, but we didn't know it could also work for Hep B. Another one of those, you know.
That's how we find out a lot in drug therapy.
Oh, yeah, no, definitely. One thing leads to another. And then ribavirin was the drug that we were assigned. It was going to be the game changer. The game changer. It was going to change all of those things. Well, what it did is increase the response by about 20%. And then came the new current, you know, class of additional what they call DAAs or direct acting agents. They added about another 20 to 30% to that, but they gave us something that the ribavirin did not give us. It allowed the treatment to be truncated in some hyper responding, super select individuals. I jokingly refer them to as the Rambo type because these people would go negative, you know, by the first month they could do truncated treatment. And for example, you know, some of these, you know, drugs could produce a 60 to 70, 80%, you know, cure rate in general. But if you were that Rambo type with a truncated treatment that could be as short as 6 months, a few months shorter, depending on the drug you're picking, they could actually get a 90 percentile response rate. It also brought up the response rates in minority patients. You know, I guess being Latino, you know, from that aspect, it's always one of those things that kind of was interesting. One of my mentors was Dr. Len Jeffers, who was one of the big researchers looking at treatments of African-American patients. African-American patients in studies would, you know, be 10% response rate, whereas everybody else was 30%. And this was, you know, depending on the drug. No matter what the drug, it was always grossly inferior. And people looked at you know, saying compliance, different things. It had nothing to do with that. It was a gene called the IL-28B. And then what happens, they realize that, unfortunately, Hispanics, African-Americans have a predominance of the bad version of it. It doesn't work as well. Think of it as like a key you had cut at the store. Mm-hmm. You ever got a really good one? Gosh, it goes straight through like butter.
It should go through, but yes, you're locked out.
Yeah, the other ones, you have to jimmy it. And then some of them, I don't care how much you jimmy it, you know, you have to get the crowbar or call somebody to get the door open. And that's what happens with that. And that bad one's called TT. The better one is CC, and then the middle is CT. And so what happened is that they were able to improve the response rates in African-Americans from about 26, 28% with the current direct-acting agents to about 62%.
Mm.
And the Latino rate.
Significant.
Oh, my gosh, yeah.
I
mean, you know, that's huge. It's a good thing. The overall response rate, you know, for Caucasians in general was in the 70 to 80%. This is very close. It's not the huge, you know, 2 to 3-fold difference. Latinos went from 35% in some of the older studies with just the dual agents, you know, to now with the new direct acting agents to be almost 70% from that aspect. So that's kind of like where we're at right now. And just as Christmas arrives, or Hanukkah, whichever one you want to celebrate at the end of this year, there's going to be a lot of interesting arrivals.
Well, tell us about some of those.
Well, the interesting arrivals that are coming are going to be the new drugs that are basically going to be what a lot of people think are game changers. So we've impressed you.
So are these in research or will these be usable?
Both.
Okay.
So let's talk about usable, because you and I both know that only 20% of drugs that are research ever get there. So from this aspect, and there was a great slide I remember from an old good researcher that I know in Florida. It's like the graveyard of drugs, and I remember waiting for all these drugs, and they just never made it. You know, from this aspect, and so the drugs that fairly certain coming out, and you're looking at probably early part of December, is going to be a new drug called sofosbuvir. And this is a drug that basically created a hepatitis C ability for treatment for the Gilead company. And they basically have it in a couple different mutations. One version will include interferon and ribavirin, along with sofosbuvir. And that version is going to basically produce about a 90% cure rate in people who are genotypes 1, 4, 5, and 6 and naive. From this aspect, it's only 10% lower in cirrhotics. Now, you say, oh, 80% doesn't sound bad. Cirrhotics never used to get better than 30%. And in general, cirrhotics with some of the current drugs right now, they went up to 60%. So now it's 80%. That's almost the same, you know, as these other people. So that's really a big impressive issue. But that's for naive. So
How will sofosbuvir be administered?
Is it it's oral? Like a, it's
okay,
once a day.
Okay.
And that's a huge advantage.
That's huge.
Yeah, because you know, with your nursing background, you know exactly what I'm talking about. A once a day pill, you know, wins it
golden.
All. Golden for
compliance
you from that aspect.
Through the roof.
Exactly. Yeah. And so it's also going to go with that drug, and then twice a day ribavirin for genotypes 2 and 3, and that's going to be all oral for naive or retreatment of genotype 2 and 3. And those numbers are scary how good they are. For genotype 2, you're looking at, you know, 95%+ of response with 3 months of it. For genotype 3, which has a higher relapse rate, unfortunately, and nobody's really ever figured out why, but, you know, I'm sure eventually somebody will figure it out, and by then it really won't matter. They'll figure out a, you know, drug for it. But genotype 3 relapses more, and so they gave them the treatment, and they had like a response rate of about 60% for them. But when they went to one extra month of treatment, in other words, 4 months, not three, all of a sudden the response rate started getting close to the 75-80%. So probably, you know, I'm not the FDA, but I would not be surprised if it's 3 months for type 2 and 4 months for type 3. And that's still an improvement over the 6 months of the interferon ribavirin that they get right now.
Okay. Now, let's go to some of the research. We talked about usable.
Yes.
So what's kind of in the can that's kind of exciting that maybe is 5 or 10 years or 2 or 3 years
out? Well, Gilead is getting ready to go in some of their trials now. They're actually doing this, as well as also a company called AbbVie, A-B-B-V-I-E. It's kind of interesting. It's an offspring from Abbott. They kind of, you know, swung off this division, and so now it's called AbbVie. They're looking at oral-only combinations for this, and they're going to be probably, you know, 3-drug regimens. From this aspect, AbbVie's got a 4-drug regimen that uses ritonavir boosting from this aspect. And they're going for the golden ring. They're going for all oral, genotype 1, whether you've been naive, previously treated with a new direct-acting agent, as well as cirrhotic. And they're going to go for 2 other really gold rings that most people have ignored up to now, which is the post-transplant hep C, which unfortunately is in a really dire strait because, you know, now they're immunosuppressed and have hep C at a higher level. And then you have HIV, which is, you know, the number one killer of HIV patients right now is hep C. So because, you know, people postpone it, oh, they weren't going to live, they weren't going to do this, and, you know, don't want to do this. And then all of a sudden the hep C treatment, you know, was postponed. And, you know, guess what? You know, they get cirrhosis and they die just like everybody else can die of these complications.
You mentioned HIV and hepatitis C. I also want to touch just for a minute on the relationship between hepatitis and cancers.
Oh, yes. Okay. Oh, okay. Well, in whatever order. Okay. So let's talk about HIV and hep C. So a lot of the risk factors, you know, that people have for hep C kind of commonality or sexual potential exposures. Mm-hmm. So if you take, you know, somebody that has sexual-only risks for HIV, there's a small chance that they can get hep C because it's not as highly sexually spread probably as much as hep B. I mean, you know, you have a sexual encounter with somebody with hep B, you know, to prove it otherwise, you're going to get hep B, you know, from that. So it's highly infectious. You take a drop of blood with hep B and a drop of blood with hep C and a drop of blood with HIV, you know, the hep B, 30 to 50% without a vaccine, you're going to get the hep B. And that's just for me going, tink, with the needle. Do the same needle to you with hep C, you got a 3 to 5% chance. Do the same needle with HIV blood, you got a 0.3%. Mm-hmm. So notice the potential risk there. So now let's say that you have HIV and you had it from intravenous drug exposures as a youth or whatever. much higher chance of having Hep B and C acquired, and also Delta and different viruses from there. So that's it's slightly different. But in the patients who have the hepatitis C and HIV, right now the treatment right now with the interferon ribavirin isn't optimal. It's really tough. It's a year treatment. Cure rates, you know, for genotype 1 are probably in the 30% higher for the genotype 2 and 3 as it always is from this aspect. But, you know, vast majority of people in this country, over 80% are genotype 1. And within type 1, it's the hardest to treat, which is 1A. And so that's where you're seeing a lot of these things. Believe it or not, that's the other thing that's neat. The researchers have figured out that within 1, 1A probably would do better than 1B. And you're going to say, well, what's the difference? It's just phylogenetically. It's the key theory. You know, you put a little tooth here, a little tooth there. It's not carved well. The key works better from that aspect. And they've shown them in some of the, even the preliminary trials where the data was disappointing in type 1, they actually showed that the type 1Bs, they were getting 60%+ cure rate versus 30% of your 1A. So that's
the refinement, yeah, is a big deal.
Oh, no, it's becoming huge. It's, yeah. We never cared if it was type 1 or not type, you know, anything other than type 1. But now it's, okay, what type of type 1?
Specificity.
Exactly.
Right, yeah, that's important.
Now, cancer, you mentioned cancer.
I did. So the link between hepatitis and cancer.
Hep B, unfortunately, 1 in 4 people that have Hep B will die of cirrhosis or cancer. 60% of the Hep B cancers will be associated without cirrhosis. So as opposed to most other hepatitis, such as Hep C or, let's say, autoimmune hepatitis or any other disorder, cirrhosis certainly is the biggest risk factor for cancer, and with about a 4% per year occurrence. With Hep B, it could happen even in anticipation before that from this aspect.
Okay, very good. And I want to talk just a little bit. We talked off air about just the psychological impact of patients when they're diagnosed with hepatitis. How it's kind of isolating, the transmission. Right. Can you speak to that just a little bit?
You know, it's tough. I mean, it's a heart-wrencher. You know, you get very close to your hepatitis patients, you know, because they confide in you, they talk to you, they open up in many ways that, you know, you're the only person who really understands them. So the first person that gets hepatitis, you know, comes out there and says, you know, I've got hepatitis, you know, B or C or whatever, immediately they're dirty.
Right.
Nobody wants to touch them. You know, there's ignorance about how you can spread it.
Entire sex life changes.
Yes, you know, that's a great advertising agent. You know, it's like, you know, the only thing worse than that would be like to hang out there and say, I have MRSA, you know, and then if you have like a shirt, say, hi, kiss me, I have MRSA, you know, the kiss me, I'm Irish sort of thing, you know, imagine trying to be, kiss me, I've got Hep C, you know, immediately like, well, can I be spread? Can it not? And so forth from there. So their dating lives are not exactly very nice from this aspect. It's actually in monogamous couples, and I recommend having any sexual changes for Hep C, but definitely for the Hep B, you really want to get so you're the vaccinated, but they've been sexually active for years. So odds are, again, with Hep B, they've been exposed already. And by the time the wife gets checked, she's already probably immune or covered, vice versa from that aspect. But some of them would be surprised the wife or the husband got it too. Remember, 5% don't get it from this aspect. So it's really tough. And so there's a stigma. You tell the ladies in church, you know, especially the front row people from that aspect that, you know, you have hepatitis and you know, they didn't even hear that you had Hep B or Hep C or Hep A. Oh, my gosh, Mrs. So-and-so, she's an alcoholic. Isn't that horrible? Mr. So-and-so must suffer with that, you know, from this aspect, you know.
Right.
So it's they hear what they want to hear, unfortunately. So if you look at that, that's why a lot of Asian patients don't really talk about it because they're afraid it'd be used against them. They have enough issues already dealing with as a minority. And so you don't see that, you know, people talk about that. And the Hep C patients, you know, they try to make their lives and they're very selective in who they open up to about this because it's just not well received, unfortunately.
Yeah, I appreciate you making a few comments about that. Well, I've learned over time with the stories that we hear that all the statistics that we've talked about today will go out of our memory very quickly. However, the stories will not. So I want you to share just a couple of memorable patient stories that have been top of mind to you, because that's what the listeners will remember.
So I'm going to share an interesting one, because one of the things that I thought about when you said that was a very interesting case. I've practiced in Florida and in Georgia, and a lot of my patients actually from Florida followed me from that aspect. Like I said, you get close to people when you've been through a lot of these, you know, things, and they feel they can trust you and that you listen and you understand, you know, their trials and tribulations from this aspect. And so I had a patient in Florida, young man who was born in Asia. He acquired hepatitis B, came to see us. You know, he was shocked. He went to donate blood, you know, positive, you know, that's not pleasant. You know, you do an altruistic thing, and by the way, your blood's no good. You know.
And you got a problem.
And you got a problem, and don't try to get life insurance or something like that, because now you got chronic Hep B all over your record. So anyway, he gets diagnosed. We treat him. Back then, what's available was interferon. I knew that that drug I had worked on as a fellow, you know, was maybe coming out, mm-hmm. you know, but it's, you know, it's a process, 3 to 5 years for these drugs to come out. And so he goes on the drug. Every side effect in the book, hair, he almost goes bald to this day. He still, you know, does not want to talk about his hair. Mm-hmm. Most of it came back, though, but that was a big issue because the interference got a lot of chemo-like mm-hmm. side effects. He goes bald, all those things. He puts up with that treatment for 6 months, feeling feverish, flu-like, sore, everything, and it doesn't work. Which it doesn't work in a lot of people, particularly if they're Asian, they acquired this at birth, it's been present most of their life. It's mm-hmm. kind of settled in from mm-hmm. this aspect. And so we put him in surveillance. We're waiting for the older drug to come out. The older drug comes out, gets approved. He started on. He's doing very well. And then along the way with surveillance, he gets close to his 40s, and lo and behold, there's a little spot. The spot kind of was seen. We did a CT. It was suspicious. Followed it up with an MRI, and yeah. It was definitely a cancer. And so he goes now for a liver resection. Luckily, he's able to do a resection because not everybody gets one. If it's in the left lobe or it's peripheral, you can cut it out. If it's deep in the heart of the right lobe, if you've got cirrhosis, which a lot of people do by that age, you know, and they've never been treated, you know, you need a transplant. But he luckily got a resection. We monitored him for that. He was doing great with that. But one thing we didn't realize about that drug when I was, you know, doing that first trial was that 20% resistant in 1 year, 70% resistance by 3 to 4 years, and he became resistant. Luckily, another drug that I was aware of came out, started him on it. It's a different class of Hep B drug. He went on that drug from that aspect, does well with that. And that drug has a 30% 5-year resistance. So 5 years later, he's got resistance to that drug. And then comes the next drug that rescues for the resistance to A and now to B, you know, drug.
The viral, yeah.
So he goes to now drug C, which is doing well for him. And drug C has got an interesting thing in that it's so powerful in the suppression that it doesn't have any resistance at 6 years so far. And that drug has been able to actually also been associated with a 72% regression of fibrosis, even from cirrhosis. So he wasn't at cirrhosis, but he was close to. So guess what? He actually doesn't have, you know, any fibrosis that's visible anymore. Even though he was close to cirrhosis, it's gone. He has basically the hepatitis under control, and he's in that 11% of people that cleared the virus.
Wow, that's a great story of hope.
So now every 6 months he comes to see me, and every 6 months he asks me, is there a well-controlled randomized trial that he could stop this drug?
Wow.
I answer no, and then he says, there's no way you're getting me not to take this medicine for the next 6 months. Give me the refill. I'll see you in 6 months.
Right.
So every 6 months we have the nice discussion, and every 6 months he comes in. We joke about it, but he leaves knowing that he's not going to stop the drug unless there's a well-controlled study. And I keep telling him, there is no controlled trial. There's nobody going to do a controlled trial. Your surface antigen negative, you know that. They don't know. Nobody knows. And he says, if nobody knows, I'm staying on the drug. I'm not doing anything else again. I'm resistant to these two drugs. You're never touching me again with interferon. I like my hair. And so he goes forward from there.
Right. You know, an interesting part of that story is especially for HIV, hepatitis, these viral diseases, you really need to be with a provider that is plugged into the research community and keeps up because it changes so fast. And this technology, just the drug technology alone, is hard to keep up with and is very, I'm sure from your perspective, very time intensive just to keep up yourself.
I tell them about the drugs, but it's so tough because, you know, it's just as we talked about before, not every drug makes it to market. Sometimes, you know, there's a lot of hype out there about these drugs. And then, you know, the reality of it is that they're not out. But, you know, the people that I see, Atlanta's a very educated community. I'm really proud of Atlanta. I tell you that I've never had people come in, they read. Maybe it's, you know, shows like yours that people are listening, they're learning, they're asking questions, you know, and they're coming in. Tell me about drug X. I'm like, wow, they heard about that drug too.
Yeah, they walk in with the article.
They walk in with the article.
Yeah, they're going to make you stay up. Yeah.
And you know, and it's one of those things. I mean, I attend the liver meeting every year. I try to go to as many of these symposiums that are coming out. I'm going to 2 symposiums coming up, learning about this new drugs class that's coming out, you know, from this aspect. And, you know, and just when I think I know about it, then they saw some article, somebody's using it, this and that and so forth. And, you know, it's always interesting because some of those articles are real. Some of them are not. Some of them are kind of like, you know, they were not well studied or there was like, you know, some study that was kind of started, but it wasn't, you know, the results weren't good enough to be followed up on. So it doesn't mean make it mainstream. And so you want them to keep in mind that knowledge is power. You can postpone the therapy if you have to for a reason. Okay, you're going to have a kid and these drugs are teratogenic. Okay, do it now from this aspect. But, you know, there's a time clock on that, and you know you can't postpone it too long, but your health is important. You know, you can only postpone things so long, and then there's a price to pay. You know, I mean, I diagnosed at least two, if not three, cancers a week. Mm-hmm. Here's the cancers of this week. You know, somebody completely metastatic everywhere. That was a horrible mm-hmm. Monday. And then, you know, today was a small lesion where we're debating, do we treat it now at less than 2 centimeters, or do we wait till it grows to 2 centimeters and now they get high priority for a liver transplant? Mm-hmm. Imagine
just
letting
play in the game. Yeah.
It's horrible. Mm-hmm. I don't know why you know did that. They used to give low priority for anything less than 2, and then they could increase it if, you know, whatever. You know, that would probably be better, but they decided to put it at 2 centimeters and above. And so now you're watching these things, and I've got the transplant people following this patient, and we're debating, do you not? And mm-hmm. the patient's thinking, Dr. Martinez, I'm a survivor of lung cancer.
It's there.
What do you want to do? And you're like, it's really tough.
Yeah.
It's really tough.
It's the system rules sometimes.
Yeah.
So the message of the show, pretty much, get checked.
Yes.
Get vaccinated.
Yes.
And find a great provider that is plugged into what you need as far as getting help.
Definitely. And the issue about the vaccines, again, very important. A lot of the companies actually have programs if you don't have insurance. Glaxo, SmithKline is one of the biggest manufacturers in the world. And they actually have a program where if you have no insurance and no coverage, you can actually get the vaccine for free. And that's information that's important. Georgia does a great job also. I'm really proud of our public health people. They really go out and they do a lot of stuff. And if you have a want or desire for a vaccine, you can get it. And they give you a lot of help on the costs and those different things. And you know, there really shouldn't be a reason not. A lot of times there are health fairs. I mean, you know, specifically a lot of the, you know, the big meetings in Atlanta and so forth, they have the vaccine program. But less than 20-30% of the people there can – I mean, there's a free vaccine sitting right for you there, and people don't get it.
Yeah, and two resources for those of you listening, www.cdc.gov/hepatitis. And also www.hepatitisfoundation.org. Both have free drug resources on their websites.
Yes.
So those are good sources. And let's tell the listeners how to find you.
Me, I am located within the AGA Liver Center, which is a subdivision of the Atlanta Gastro Group. We're located at the Emory Midtown location. From this aspect, and our office information, I'm sure, is on your webpage there, mm-hmm. but it's 404-881-1094, and then they can go through the scheduling process from that aspect. I know most of the docs in town from that aspect because, you know, we communicate a lot with people, and there are not that many people that just do liver disease. I mean, you're either a liver disease person at a transplant center, and if you're at a transplant center, you're pretty busy from this aspect, or you're having your own liver center, and you're still pretty busy, but mm-hmm. you probably have a little bit more time than the guy at the transplant center, and you can answer a lot more calls and stuff like that from the docs and anything that they can do. If they can't come to Atlanta, seek out a provider. Your knowledge is power. Most primary care doctors are in a big screening mode right now. I think as the drugs go oral, I can envision in the next 5 years if the drugs are oral with limited side effects that this could potentially be, you know, Mr. So-and-so, I'm sorry, I found the hep C in your screening test, but the good news is you're genotype 1 and there's this oral pill I can give you for the next 3 months that's going to give you a 90% cure rate. And then if it doesn't work, we'll have Dr. Martinez try to figure out how to give you some new other experimental drug. And God knows what we'll be doing there. I mean, mm-hmm. there are people looking now at what that's called, the macrophage function. And just like, you know, when you shake hands, when you see somebody, you have parts of the macrophage that actually are the part where it interacts and it basically sticks to the infected cells. There are actually ways that they're working on now for Hep B infected cells to actually be eradicated by this. And it's actually now leaving the research lab to be looked at in the first human trials. Still 5 to 10 years away. We'll see if they can kind of make it happen. But they're working on all these, you know, different receptors and so forth. And I think in Hep C, we're going to see the same evolution as with HIV. We're going to see, you
long
know,
lives.
Long lives. There'll be some people can take once a day therapy that'll be right. triple drug, quadruple drug regimens.
Low viral loads.
Low viral
undetectable.
Load.
Yeah.
Some people get resistance, and those people will have different treatments that we do. Some of it may include interferons, some may not. And then there's a whole other class of drugs. And that's the beauty of it. Knowledge is power. Each time they learn something new, they figure out the next step forward from there. And who knows, you know. Maybe, you know, Scotty and his, you know
beam me up,
Scotty. It'll work.
Those little diagnostic things.
Yeah, they'll have those scanners.
Float over
they'll be
us
able to
and
do
we'll
that.
Be all fixed
and,
up.
They'll do that, and bones will be able to be resuscitated.
There you go. Well, thanks so much for joining us. You're truly an Atlanta treasure and resource for us. We appreciate you being here.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks to the listeners. Please also log on to HealthGate at www.healthgate.com, our sponsor, and see how they can help you. Thanks for listening.
The Doctor's Roundtable has been a production brought to you by HealthGate and Business Radio X. HealthGate is a groundbreaking website where board-certified doctors and specialists offer savings on out-of-pocket healthcare costs. For more information about HealthGate, please visit www.healthgate.com or call 404-692-5377. We hope you tune in next week, and thank you for listening.